I have to admit, I didn't know much about anarchy or the history of anarchy when I heard about this conference and decided I would write a paper, so I had to do a little bit of self-education. So if there's anything that's off, I'll apologize now. Okay, I'm a Native American. I grew up in Northwest Canada with the Salish people. I'm Cree, but I grew up with the Salish people in a traditional community, so I think I've been blessed with having a dual worldview. Academia is the third of those worldviews. It's a completely different social circle, and it's where I learned to call myself and identify myself as a person who's red. Before that, I didn't have a color, but I now understand Vine Deloria's directions. Okay. Historically, many enlightened thinkers have been accused of being anarchists. The Taoist Lao Tzu, Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, Carl Einstein, Oscar Wilde, to name a few. The contemporary description of an anarchist is anarchist, a person who promotes disorder or excites revolt against any established law, rule, or custom. That's from Webster's. This definition of an anarchist may be bestowed upon anyone who comes into a Western academic or politically dominated arena with an indigenous worldview and philosophy that challenges the validity and knowledge and science produced by Western academics, or the hierarchical social structure of neo-colonialist power rulers, whose first law of an acceptable society, it seems, is the exclusion of others. I've had to wonder then how it is that many people who have been historically accused of being anarchists, accused of being lawbreakers and troublemakers, are now recognized as some of the world's greatest thinkers and advocates of peace and civil rights. It could be said that historically, power structures seeking to maintain and control people and profits used the label anarchist as a slur in an attempt to degrade human activists in the public view. In this frame of hierarchical ethnocentric rule, some indigenous people become activists by default, by being the voice, willing or not, of their oppressed and marginalized communities. Anarchist is a term that was historically employed by European colonialists whose political and financial gain through brutal regimes of power was the driving force of an attempted genocide in many areas of the world. Regimes that freely labeled any voice of human rights with the slander and the title of anarchist. Regimes that threatened and delivered beatings and jail terms for free thinkers. Anarchists in America and many other areas can carry a heavy negative connotation. Labeling someone an anarchist nowadays, and you relegate them to the annals of other infamous troublemakers, such as Greenpeace, Martin Luther King, Leonard Peltier, Ward Churchill, and the halls of fame of those investigated by the FBI. The act of fighting for human rights and the future of his people landed Nelson Mandela in prison for 27 years. However, he persevered, and after being released from prison, he continued his crusade and became the president of South Africa, and he won a Nobel Peace Prize. American Indian civil rights activists, members of the American Indian Movement AIM, have also been jailed. In fact, one of the founders of AIM sits in a prison only a few hundred miles from here in Pennsylvania. He was recently denied parole after serving 33 years in prison. He's been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize every year for the last 7 years. Leonard Peltier has paid the price and is still paying the price for fighting for the rights of American Indian people. people for being their voice. Peltier was accused of killing two FBI agents in the midst of a gun battle, where at least 10 other people were armed. However, it's very obvious that if the FBI were not driving around on Pine Ridge Reservation, had not driven at high speeds into the yard of a home where Peltier and other AIM members were sitting minding their own business, and the FBI, if they were not actively trying to quash American Indian civil rights activists on the sovereign territory of Pine Ridge Reservation, Leonard Peltier may have never been imprisoned. American Indian academics have addressed civil rights issues in America and critiqued the academic and political arenas who so eagerly promote historical misinformation, which is taught as facts and creates a naive worldview and fuels racial bias. Vine Deloria, an American Indian author, theologian, historian, and activist, wrote a critique of Western anthropological history of America. In his book, Red Earth, White Lies, Native Americans and the Myth of Scientific Fact, was originally published in 1995. The book's central theme was to criticize the scientific consensus, which in his words, created a largely fictional scenario describing prehistoric North America. American anthropological literature has historically been devoid of any Amerindian knowledge or philosophy. It is a history that has been written from strictly a Western lens, created with Western philosophy and ideology. And in this, I would agree with the central tenet of Deloria's work. How is it possible for academics to reconstruct the history of a people whose philosophy and cultural traditions, including their oral histories, have been historically and contemporarily invalidated by an exclusionary praxis? According to Sonia Atlee, Native Americans in this country faced, as a part of the colonial process, the theft, appropriation, misrepresentation of our history, cultural heritage, intellectual and cultural property. Even the bodies of our ancestors were not sacred in this assault. As David Hurst Thomas and others have demonstrated so powerfully, the rise of archaeology played an important role in the colonization process. And the results of this process and the results of this conflict remain with us today, many of them in institutional racism. To lose your life is to lose your future. To lose your liberty is to lose your present. And to lose the product of your life and liberty is to lose that portion of your past that produced it. I speak out and address the American Indian past that has been stolen and appropriated through a lens of ethnocentric Western knowledge production. Historical essentialist discourse on American Indian people and culture in American academic textbooks begs to be rewritten, inclusive of American Indian authors, philosophies, and oral histories, to address historical sanitization and minimalization of American Indian people, populations, achievements, and rights, which have for many years been deeply buried in the mire of an archaic terra nullius. However, it is not a simple matter for indigenous or other academics to rewrite a history, even though there is documentation available on literally thousands and thousands of archaeological sites and of the incredible diversity of American Indian cultures. Many of the gatekeepers of academia cling tightly to their power, guarding a strongly vested interest in the construction of knowledge. The mindset of exclusion of indigenous knowledge, philosophies, and people in academic and other institutions is deeply rooted in a political and historical colonial context. The rhetoric of colonialism is a comfortable fit for those who fear the equality and validity of American Indian academics, knowledge, and ideologies. The discursive practice of old guard academics, devaluing indigenous knowledge and rights, and fueling the fires of inferiority exist in American academic settings today. Though there are enlightened academics that welcome indigenous knowledge and scholars, and academic institutions which are deemed as more Indian friendly, it has been my personal experience that they are vastly outnumbered by the gatekeepers of hierarchical academia. To challenge the existing Western-produced history of American Indian cultures is to invoke all that is anarchy, to scream against the organized structure of years of vested interest, power, and control. An anarchist theory in which all people are equal would greatly benefit American anthropology. However, anthropologists and anthropology in America had to be ordered by the federal government in 1991 to consult with indigenous people on excavations of their own burial sites on federal land. I've had many graduate students tell me they do not agree with the ideologies and educational agendas of their professors, but they just want to get their degrees, so they stay silent. I don't seem to have that opinion. Often, my mouth has a mind of its own. Even when I go into a class or a lecture and I tell my mouth it's going to stay shut and just listen, it never happens. You see, I think my parents were anarchists, perhaps not intentionally, but nonetheless in practice. Unlike many of my peers, I did not grow up in a well-structured home environment. In fact, there was no structure at all, no rules, no expectations. I grew up as free as the wind, with total autonomy. I know what my parents were thinking. There were no barriers, no impossibilities, nowhere my imagination could not go. I was never told to shut up. I was never told to not have an opinion. So by the time I began public school, I was deemed a problem child. One who knew nothing but the right to free thought. One whose main flaw was the failure to recognize the hierarchical authority of those in power. A quote from the Carnival of Anarchy states, "The role of the education system in a democratic society is a key one. It serves as a vital part of the indoctrination process necessary to maintain collectivist belief and homogeneity." I would agree and argue that the American education system has done a fine job of indoctrinating students in a hierarchical system often based on race. American educational textbooks give little space to American Indians, and when they do, it's a history produced under the guise of expertise, often by hypocritical people with one face in public and another in private. When they do give space to Native American history, it is a history produced by anthropologists from the archaeological record. The problem is that Western-trained anthropologists, non-Indigenous archaeologists, have the history written, constrained in time and space, often dictated by dogmatic misinformation and ideologies, before they even ever leave the office to excavate. This has been my experience in 5 years of fieldwork. Every field director I ever worked under had it in their mind before we went to a site, what would be there, how old it would be, how deep it would be, and the technicians or crew chiefs were allowed to report nothing else. Western academic knowledge producers often construct the history of a culture they have never interacted with. And it's not just what they write that's so damaging, it's what they leave out. James W. Lowen, in his book, 1995 book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, stated that a hidden history is a crime against all people, and I would agree with him. How can anyone build a worldview of a history without the historical facts to substantiate their opinions? Yet in American education, the true history of the American Holocaust and genocide has been hidden. The incredible and deep history of American people diminished, sanitized, and marginalized, and indigenous knowledge constantly excluded from academia. Everyone knows about the African slave trade, but no one seems to know of the first transatlantic slave trade that took place under Columbus. Thousands of American Indian people, Amerindian people, including the entire Natchez Nation hauled off in chains, were sold in Europe, the West Indies, and other countries into slavery by Columbus and those that followed him. The Beothuk people who are extinct were sold to the West Indies in entirety. In America, when textbooks heroify Columbus, they encourage readers to identify with the oppressors and to create a human disconnect with the oppressed. It is now the charge of indigenous academics and others who support teaching the truth to try to rewrite hundreds of years of misinformation that only negatively impacts the lives of contemporary indigenous population. And it robs all people of the opportunity to form the worldview of others based on historical truths. In America, there are over 800 extant Native American nations, 564 federally recognized, which is not a measure of Indianness. It's strictly a measure of how well you can jump through hoops to try to retain your own cultural identity. These Native American nations are one people, diverse yet unified in blood and a common history of struggle against the physical and cultural genocide which continues through institutional racism and indoctrinated racially biased education in contemporary times. Any group of Native Americans who have risen up to make demands for fair and equal treatment, for a return of lands, for the protection of spiritual places, for inclusion in anthropology, for a right to practice their religion and culture and their traditions, for a voice in the treatment of their ancestors' remains and artifacts, have been labeled as troublemakers. Indigenous American anthropologists have critiqued the academic system, and in doing so, they walk a very fine line between tenure possibilities and academic destruction. In Indigenous Scholars versus the Status Quo, Devin Mahushier and Angela Cavander stated that natives are hired in order to meet a quota for minority hires. But if a native scholar continues to be active in the quest for decolonization and empowerment and recovery, they are in for a perpetually bumpy road to the edge of tenure, only to face the reality of not receiving tenure. Those who do conform, however, become the Indian experts, cited by white scholars, because they think, behave, and write like them. Oops, put that one. According to Cordova, Native Americans have managed to survive the onslaught of assimilation and outright eradication with an intact cultural identity. Cordova further stated that Native Americans have been placed in a unique situation of having to understand two very different worldviews. They have been exposed from childhood to competing and often contradictory value systems. The average Euro-American lacks this experience of competing worldviews and value systems. His world reinforces the dominant view. He cannot know that he exists in a self-referential system of thought. Many Euro-American academics do not seem concerned with American anthropology's dark history. American academic leaders expect red anthropologists to walk into academia and agree with a sanitization of history, of genocide, and of the historical abuses of anthropology in America. How is it that intellectuals who make their living from the study of indigenous peoples in the America can be so disconnected from the impacts of an extremely biased and sanitized knowledge production on contemporary indigenous populations? According to Annette Arcatea, institutional racism towards Native Americans has the longest history of any racism in this country. Institutional racism is the practice of double standards, taught and advocated at all institutions and governmental levels of a society. It is the insidious, systematic, and singling out of a race and the subjugation of that race by policy and practice. This practice diminishes humanity. Yet American educational institutions continue to teach of Columbus as a hero. Worse yet is that millions of Americans stand by and say nothing or join in the celebrations. Martin Luther King addressed many issues of racial bias and exclusion and challenged politicians and academics to change America. In his struggles for a free and equal America, King felt the heavy hand of institutional and governmental intimidation amongst his colleagues and his best friends. He stated, "I would rather face my enemies than the silence of my friends." And I agree with him. It is very disturbing to watch those who know of institutional racism agree with their silence on issues of bias, exclusion, and when racism surfaces. The silence of intimidation of academic power is a very sad fact in some academic settings. When students cannot debate and have to consider that if they speak up, support their indigenous peers, and confront marginalization and racism, they may face certain ostracization in their own academic institutions. Gandhi, in the face of persecution, stated, "They may beat me, they may jail me, they may break my bones, they may even take my life, but they will never have my obedience." And to echo Gandhi, with my humblest apologies, I will add, they may marginalize me. They may use their assumed power, expertise, and authority to attempt to demoralize me. They may even attempt to academically demolish me. But they will never have. They will never have my blind obedience to an academy of exclusionary praxis. Red anthropologists have only to disagree with the centralized colonialist knowledge production to earn their anarchist label. If critiquing an ethnocentric body of knowledge on Native American history produced exclusive of Native American philosophies and ways of knowing makes me an anarchist against the power and hierarchical structure of historical and contemporary anthropology, then hell yeah, I'm gonna get that word tattooed on my buttocks. And maybe I'll pull a Forrest Gump. Look, Brandon, it's where I got injured. Here's what I identify with. Finally, I would like to add, if you are an academic and one of your peers or students is an indigenous person who is labeled as a troublemaker and an anarchist, and you know of the historic bias and misrepresentations of that indigenous people face in many Western academic arenas, do not ask why they are a voice of opposition or anarchy. Ask yourself why you are not. I support an anarchist praxis of inclusion, the acceptance and validity of other ways of knowing. I would argue that the possible benefits of an anarchist anthropological, methodological, and theory of engagement would greatly benefit the anthropological recordation of American Indian history.